I appreciate that song too, Shane. The verse David highlighted, he makes the nations prove the whatever it goes on to say. But we'll be seeing this evening how indeed God makes the nations prove the wonders of his righteousness. I'm going to be sharing this evening from the historical perspective, and my title is Five Epochs of Redemptive History, borrowing primarily from Ralph Winter's article in this book entitled The Kingdom Strikes Back. He highlights 10 eras of history, five from the time of the patriarchs until Christ, and five from the time of Christ until present, each of those 400 years long. I will be talking only about the five from the time of Christ until now. I'll just tell you up front, those eras, from 0 to 400 AD, we have winning the Romans. From 400 to 800, winning the barbarians. 8 to 1200, winning the Vikings. 12 to 1600, with a big question mark, is winning the Muslims. I believe we all know what happened then. And 1600 to present, winning the ends of the earth. I'm going to start us off with a quote from our own Gideon Utsi that he shared in Sunday school just this past Sunday, and he was kind enough to put it into writing for me. We're talking about John 3:16 in that lesson. Gideon said this, "I think it is possible to overemphasize personal salvation when we present the gospel. The gospel is first and foremost about what God is doing in the whole cosmos. If we can catch a vision for that, we stand a better chance of making an impact with our brief time on earth. In the past 50 years, none of the Bible's 30,000 plus verses have been more popular than John 3:16. It is a moving verse and an important verse, but an overemphasis on it causes Christianity to become too focused on making sure that we as individuals are saved and going to heaven. I can't help but wonder what the flavor of American Christianity would be if 1 John 3:16 had been the theme verse instead. Hereby perceive we the love of God, because he laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for the brethren. Or perhaps Matthew 28:18-20, which is the Great Commission." We're going to see this evening that this isn't just an American issue, maybe becoming inward focused. As we look at each of these eras, we'll see a pattern evolve. We move from, well, you can start anywhere you want, really, but complacency, then tumult, in which, or after which, the faith thrives, and then from that thriving, prosperity, and then the prosperity breeds complacency, and the cycle just repeats itself. And over 2,000 years since the time of Christ, as I studied this, I got incredibly frustrated at that, seeing that cycle over and over and over again. And so I want you to be thinking as we go through this evening about where we are at in the present cycle and how that should impact the way we live and the way we think. It needs to be said that Winter does not use this pattern to make any prophetic declarations of the future. It's simply an observation of the past. And for those of you who know history well, I also need to say that these are not tidy little 400-year segments of time. It's a framework that we use that's helpful. So moving right in to winning the Romans. 0 to 400 AD. The Jews chafed under Roman rule for about six decades before the time of Christ. And their disappointment in Jesus for not just coming and freeing them from the Romans blinded them to the fact that Rome was not so much something to be freed from as it was a tool to be used by God. By the time of Christ, Rome had become one of, if not the largest empire in the world. And that brought about several things that I think we're fairly familiar with. But the Roman peace, this included common language, about 250,000 miles of excellent roads, and a relatively quick mail system. So the communication was good. At this time, there were also many Jews living outside of Judea throughout the Roman Empire. Many scholars believe that their numbers had reached 10% of the Roman population by the time of Christ. I was unaware of that. That's a lot. That is a lot of Jews living throughout the Roman Empire. I was also interested to find that for the most part, they were very well liked and respected by their Gentile neighbors. That is according to some, at least. And they attracted many Gentiles, at least to the fringes of their religious communities, Cornelius being one that we're familiar with from the Bible. So this new faith spread at a breathtaking pace until it was no longer reasonable to persecute it. There were so many Christians throughout Rome. It eventually became tolerated, and about 50 years after that, it became the official religion of Rome. Christianity became the official religion of Rome under Constantine. Ralph Winter, speaking on the conversion of Constantine, says, "By this time in history, the inescapable fact is that there were enough Christians in the Roman Empire to make an official reversal of policy toward Christianity not only feasible, but politically wise." He goes on to quote Professor Lynn White Jr. of UCLA, "Even if Constantine had not become a Christian, the empire could not have held out against Christianity more than another decade or two." And we're familiar with what Constantine did to Christianity by making it the official religion. But I want to look into a few aspects of that yet. Something I had not considered before, some of the other dynamics in that, is that what the areas that became the Roman Empire were fairly locally run city-states. And many of the people lost their sense of identity when they just became part of the massive Roman Empire. There was some of that sense of belonging was gone. And Christianity came out as this religion for all people. And that, in fact, is where we see that the Jews' rejection of Christ, the Jews' rejection of Christianity, may have actually, ironically, helped the spread of the gospel. It's probably a bit controversial to say that, and I'm not saying that it's good that they rejected Christ. But so much religion has always been tied to politics. And if the Jews as a nation had embraced Christianity, very likely would have simply become the Jewish nation's religion. And we know that they didn't particularly like Rome, and so right there you have a barrier between Christianity and Roman society. And what Constantine did by making Christianity the official religion was he immediately put up that barrier of politics and Christianity, so that whereas the gospel was starting to spread outside of Rome, immediately persecution started because Rome's neighbors wanted nothing to do with this Roman religion. And I think we do well to ponder that. I forgot to say at the beginning that I feel kind of apologetic for the way I am going to blaze through history here tonight and skip over many very important things. But we have about 45 minutes to cover about 2,000 years of history. So here we go. As with all empires, Rome began to decline. And so these barbarian tribes, the Gothic barbarians, had been partially Christianized. They were nominally Arian Christians, which I know very little about that, but it was considered a heretical branch of Christianity at this time. But the Gothic barbarians were at least nominally Christian for the most part. They were threatening the city of Rome, and Rome pulled their legions out of Britain to aid in her defense in the city of Rome. And as a result, Britain very quickly fell to bands of other barbarians who were totally pagan with no influence of Christianity yet. And as they were invaded, they became infected with the gospel. As they invaded Rome, these barbarians from the outside, Rome was not reaching out. All of the Christian efforts were focused inward. And the barbarians came in, invaded Rome, but as a part of the process, became familiar with the gospel. Rome was not the only place the gospel was advancing. So much of our New Testament is through the eyes of Paul. And so I tend to just picture Christianity growing in Rome. I was actually surprised to find that most of the apostles went east after Jesus, when they dispersed. Many of them went east. Thomas, I think most of us know, went as far as India, where he died. I think part of the reason Christianity spread so rapidly in Rome is that Western Europe had mostly kind of tribal localized religions. So the gospel could come into an area and kind of overwhelm an entire brand of religion at one time. In the East, they ran into really well-established regional religions. Hinduism, for example, developed between 1900 and 1400 BC and experienced its golden age from 200 BC to 500 AD. So this is a direct overlap of when the gospel is advancing in Asia. And the caste system also was a huge challenge. So Christianity grew and it thrived, and there were strong churches and vibrant churches, but they did not see the rate of growth. Christianity survived in Asia, but they also experienced an enormous amount of persecution. So Rome is in the process of falling here, and we move into the era of the barbarians from 400 to 800. And that earlier invasion that I had referenced, I believe, came at around 231 AD. So there's some pretty big overlap here. I'm going to read an excerpt from Wikipedia in reference to the barbarian invasion. In 251 AD, the Gothic army raided the Roman provinces of Moesia and Thrace, defeated and killed the Roman emperor Decius, and took a number of predominantly female captives, many of which were Christian. This is assumed to represent the first lasting contact of the Goths with Christianity. The conversion of the Goths to Christianity was a relatively swift process, facilitated by the assimilation of Christian captives into Gothic society. Within a few generations of their appearance on the borders of the empire in 238 AD, the conversion of the Goths to Christianity was nearly all-inclusive. The Christian cross appeared on coins in Gothic Crimea shortly after the Edict of Tolerance was issued in 311. And a bishop by the name of Theophilus Gothae was present at the First Council of Nicaea in 325 AD. However, fighting between pagan and Christian Goths continued throughout this period, and religious persecutions echoing that of Diocletian occurred frequently. Quoting from Ralph Winter, "In any case, we confront the ominous phenomenon of partially Christianized barbarian hordes being emboldened and enabled, listen carefully, to pour in on a complacent, officially Christian empire that had failed to effectively reach out to them." So as Rome was crumbling in the West, a 14-year-old boy was kidnapped by pirates from Britain. He was taken to Ireland, where he was sold into slavery. Enslaved as a shepherd, Patrick learned to keep company with God and prayed constantly. He wrote, "The love of God and his fear grew in me more and more, as did the faith, and my soul was roused, so that in a single day I have said as many as 100 prayers, and in the night nearly the same. I prayed in the woods and on the mountain, even before dawn. I felt no hurt from the snow or ice or rain." At the age of 20, he was told in a dream to escape to the coast. When he arrived there, he found a ship bound for his homeland. And after a very complex journey, he made it back safely and found his family again. He resumed, or I should say, he began religious studies and educated himself, or was educated in the faith, and went about his life for about 20 years, until at the age of 40, he received another vision. He says, "I saw a man coming, as it were, from Ireland. His name was Victoricus, and he carried many letters, and he gave me one of them. I read the heading, 'The Voice of the Irish.' As I began the letter, I imagined in that moment that I heard the voice of those very people who were near the woods of Fosslet, which is beside the Western Sea, and they cried out as with one voice, 'We appeal to you, holy servant boy, to come and walk among us.'" And in 433, St. Patrick returned to Ireland. He was not the first missionary to Ireland, as is sometimes claimed. But what made him very impactful was that he had been enslaved to a chieftain Ireland had a caste system, much like India, and he was enslaved to a very high-level person. And because of that experience, he understood that to reach the people of Ireland, he needed to start with the chieftains. He needed to start at the very top and gain influence through them. And he was spectacularly successful in his mission efforts. His mission efforts led not only to the conversion of most of Ireland, but also sparked a movement of Celtic missions that advanced the gospel rapidly throughout parts of Western Europe not reached by Rome. These missionaries set out in bands of 13. They kind of followed the pattern of Jesus and his disciples, one leader with about 12 disciples. And I don't know for how long a period they did this, but they would kind of wander through the countryside. They were culturally sensitive, and they took an approach that worked in that time. As I understand, the people of Ireland at this time were kind of a wandering people. I don't know if you would say nomadic, but wanderers were not looked at strangely, and in fact were received warmly. So this model, okay, I need to back up. So as these 12 disciples matured in faith, many of them would break off from the group and take 12 more disciples to learn under them. And so through this, you have a rapid growth of missionaries, and not just a growth of the gospel, but a growth of actual missionaries. And I was really captured by that. I think that's really beautiful. So they were very brave missionaries and very, very dedicated, but they also understood the need for community. They understood that they couldn't just go out there and continuously wander through the land. They knew that they needed each other, and it was out of that that the monastic system was born. And the writers in this book try to make it clear that it was a form of monasticism that did not carry many of the negative things with it that we've more recently come to associate with it. Paul Cullity, in a paper entitled Monasticism, the Heart of Celtic Christianity, wrote this: "If you want to capture the idea of Celtic monasticism in words, you'll find that words themselves seem inadequate. I have struggled for weeks now to present the essence of this movement, and I find it no easier now than when I started. Every word I choose has a sense of passion, of vitality, of enthusiasm, of intense dedication, and yet these extravagant phrases fall short of catching the elusive nature of my subject. To call the Celtic Church rich would be to create an image of financial wealth that actually it never enjoyed. To call it poor would be to do injustice to the lasting treasures it endowed on all who encountered it. To even use the words monastic or monk conjure up images quite different for most of us than what really occurred. I am left with a sense of reaching for the right words, but finding them just beyond my grasp. I'm afraid that this is exactly what happens when we try to dissect or analyze a living thing." And after doing some study on the Celtic Church, I too was left with a bit of that sense of wonder at what a few brave men were able to accomplish and the movement that they started. So these monastic communities were not just centers of spiritual growth, and education, but they preserved the technologies of the Roman industry, such as tanning, dyeing, weaving, metalworking, masonry, etc. They cultivated and maintained those skills. Quoting Winter yet again, their civil, charitable, and even scientific contributions are in general grossly underestimated, especially by Protestants who have developed unfriendly stereotypes about monks. One of their great contributions is the preservation and copying of countless manuscripts, both Christian and secular. This is what really surprised me. Nearly all of what we know about Roman history comes from their libraries. If not for them, we would know no more about Rome than the Mayan or Inca civilizations. So that is maybe not directly gospel related, but it's a way that we today are still benefiting from these dedicated followers of Christ. So we find ourselves at around the year 800, and Rome has declined greatly, well into the Dark Ages. But Charlemagne came to power, and he was another Christian emperor. Some would say much more Christian than Constantine, from what I was seeing, then it seems like the bar must have been set pretty low. But he ushered in a wonderful period known as the Carolingian Renaissance, a fairly brief renaissance during the Dark Ages. And during this time, education, the arts, and Christianity flourished again. Once again, his efforts at Christianizing were turned inward, were turned toward empire. It was All of the efforts were to benefit empire. A few brave missionaries were sent out, and they were very quickly done away with because of their association with Rome. Their neighbors wanted nothing to do with them. So, once again, the Christians have become complacent. They've thrived for a little bit, they've become prosperous, they've become complacent. But God will stop at nothing to get his message out. And if his people will not go to the surrounding nations, he will bring the nations to his people. And the people he brought were the Vikings. No sooner had Charlemagne kind of reconsolidated Western Europe than the Vikings swooped in with a savagery not known in these parts for hundreds of years. Well, most of the barbarians that invaded earlier were sort of Christian, at least enough to have a deep respect for the churches and for the clergy and for the religious sites. They didn't do too much there. The Vikings seemed to target the churches. They slaughtered the clergy and they looted the churches and burned them to the ground. And it seems very targeted. There are a few theories for why that was the case. One really good reason is that, good bad reason, is that the churches had become centers of opulence and wealth, and they were filled with treasure. They were a looter's dream. An even sadder belief is that the Vikings specifically targeted Christians because of unpleasant dealings with traders, with Christian traders, and with Charlemagne's Christian army. And they came in, and the Christians were the first thing that had to be dealt with because of that. That's a theory. It may or may not be true, but it is very sobering. One contemporary of this time wrote, "The Northmen cease not to slay and carry into captivity the Christian people, to destroy the churches and burn the towns. Everywhere there is nothing but dead bodies, clergy and laymen, nobles and common people, women and children. There is no road or place where the ground is not covered with corpses. We live in distress and anguish at this spectacle of the destruction of the Christian people." And the Anglican prayer book even contains this prayer, "From the fury of the Northmen, O Lord, save us." Ireland and England had geographically been incredibly strategic in the Celtic mission advances. They had very early on built mission home bases on islands off of England that made from where they could go kind of anywhere in Western Europe. For the same reason, the Vikings needed those spots for their military conquests. And so those two very first Celtic home bases were incidentally the very first two places attacked by the Vikings. They overwhelmed Ireland, what we would now call the British Isles, and the Celtic Christianity in that region faded out very quickly in a very dark period of history. Once again, God's purposes will not be thwarted. And while these conquerors came in and were doing their best, it seems intentionally, to stamp out the faith, what happened was quite the opposite. They sold monks into slavery, and they took women and girls to be their wives and mistresses, most of these people being Christians. And although they may have been complacent, they took the gospel to the Vikings. And it was these unfortunate captives who eventually conquered the North with the gospel. I'm going to read a section from the textbook here, a few paragraphs here. This is from Ralph Winter again. "In any case, as Christopher Dawson puts it, the unparalleled devastation of England and the continent was, quote, not a victory for paganism, end quote. The Northmen who landed on the continent under Royal eventually became Christianized Normans. The Danish who took over a huge section of Middle England, along with the invaders from Norway who planted their own kind in many other parts of England and Ireland, were soon to also become Christians as a consequence. The gospel was too powerful. Christian culture spread back into Scandinavia. This stemmed largely from England, from which came the first monastic communities and early missionary bishops. What England lost, Scandinavia gained." What England lost, Scandinavia gained. Oh, here's another one I need to read. "The scene was now an enlarged Europe in which no secular ruler could survive without at least tipping his hat to the leaders in the Christian movement. It was a period in which European Christians had not reached out in missions, but in which they had at least with phenomenal speed become a presence in the entire northern area, and had also deepened the foundations of Christian scholarship and devotion that had been passed on from the Europe of Charlemagne. Both happy and unhappy surprises would unfold in the next period. Would Europe now take the initiative in reaching out with the gospel? Would it sink into self-satisfaction? In some respects, it would do both." They did reach out and they reached out in the most tragic way I can imagine. Sadly, this next era of bloodshed and violence is not Christians suffering at the hands of their neighbors, but rather Christians turning on their pagan neighbors. In the greatest possible perversion of the Christian mandate. Once again, Christianity became a political kingdom, and it tried to advance using the same methods of political kingdoms. We ruled rather than serving. We took instead of giving. Where we should have built up, we destroyed. Where we should have brought the gospel of life, we killed with the sword. Pardon me. Didn't expect this. But this time in history is a heartbreaking era for me. I learned something in this study that surprised me about Islam and the Christians' response to it, or I should say Islam's response to Christianity. Unfortunately, Winter speaking again, unfortunately, little was known of Islam in Europe. The first completed translation of the Quran into Latin would not take place until the 12th century, and even then it would not be published until four centuries later. Had European Christians made the effort to read the Muslims' holy book, they may have been surprised at how much the two faiths have in common. Indeed, modern scholarship has increasingly revealed the strong Christian foundation upon which Islam was built. The Quran itself reads almost as a collection of various Christian traditions held sacred throughout the world in the 7th century. It is likely that its editors were attempting to integrate the fractured Christian community into the newly formed Arabic Empire of the 7th century, which had swallowed almost half of Christendom. However, as a result of the Crusades, Muslim scholarship itself began to change in its interpretation of the Quran. From then on, verses in the Quran about Jesus, of which there are over 90, began to be interpreted in an increasingly anti-Christian manner. Today, for example, it is almost universally believed throughout the Muslim world that Jesus did not die on the cross. However, this was certainly not always the case, and the Quran can be shown to confirm his crucifixion and resurrection. This change happened when Christians began to use the cross as a symbol of military conquest. Jews, Muslims, and pagans all fell by the sword of Christianity rather than being brought to kneel before the cross of Christ. And we are still feeling the impact of that today. Just imagine if all of the resources, the energy, the passion, the bravery, the risk-taking, not to mention the financial resources that were poured into the Crusades. What if that had been poured into a legitimate mission outreach? Take a moment and think about what the world might look like today if that had happened. Would the current conflict with radical Islam even exist? I'm going to say probably not. Because, at least according to some, we Christians actually changed the shape of Islam drastically for the worse. This is a very tumultuous era, this era 1200 to 1600. It includes, besides all the violence of the Crusades, the menace of the Black Death, which brought greater setback than the Gothic, Anglo-Saxon, or Viking invasions. But there were bright spots in this time, and possibly the brightest spot in this time was the truly good man, Francis of Assisi. Born in 1181 or 82, not sure, to a very wealthy merchant, he spent his first 20 years or so enjoying the upper class lifestyle. He went off to war a few times and went traveling some and joined his father in business, and he was set. But he kept having these experiences that just wouldn't leave him alone. Some of them very mystical and spiritual, some of them as simple as meeting beggars on the street, and he just couldn't leave them alone. In one case, he was doing business, he was with his father, he had to just kind of push the beggar along. And later on, he ran after the beggar and tracked him down and gave him everything in his pockets. Experiences like this led him to reject his life of affluence, and he turned to a life of poverty, even becoming a beggar at times. And he cared for the sick in the leper colony. So he risked his own life to care for the sick. In 1209, after hearing a sermon on Matthew 10:9, he set off with a rough garment, barefoot, and after the gospel precept, without staff or scrip, and he began to preach repentance. He was soon joined by his first follower, interestingly also a prominent fellow townsman, who contributed all that he had to the work. Within a year, Francis had 11 followers. He chose never to be ordained as a priest, but rather called his little group the Lesser Brothers. They lived a simple life near Assisi, but spent much of the time wandering through the mountainous districts of Umbria, always cheerful and full of songs, and yet making a deep impression on all who encountered them, and all who heard their earnest exhortations. This was unusual because he was not licensed to preach, which was, I guess, a great offense at this time. But he composed a simple rule for he and his lesser brothers to follow. And that one rule was simply to follow the teachings of our Lord Jesus Christ and to walk in his footsteps. That was their guiding principle. But he and his 11 followers went to Rome in that same year, 1209, to seek permission from the Pope to found a new religious order. They were really not aligned with Rome's political goals at the time, and the Pope was very reluctant to grant this favor to him. But he received a dream, and in which he saw Francis holding up the Basilica of St. John, which was at the time the home church of all Christendom. And so he gave permission, and the Franciscan order was established. And what this did was it allowed him the freedom to go about and preach on the streets and to witness without being arrested or accused of heresy, because he was now officially sanctioned by the church. Interestingly, this little order centered around poverty and self-sacrifice grew rapidly, and it didn't just attract poor people. It attracted many prominent and very wealthy people. It seems that in this time of all this bloodshed and turmoil, there were still believers who simply wanted to live like Jesus and who simply wanted to follow the path of Jesus and live as he did. Trying to see how much I can cover here. I have way too much material, and I'm just trying to blaze through. Yeah, this is important. One of his most fascinating adventures came in 1219 during the Fifth Crusade. A crusading army had besieged a prominent Egyptian city, and Francis traveled to the front lines of battle, and his goal was to convert the Sultan peacefully. And during a truce, which is said to have lasted about 4 weeks, a ceasefire between the two armies, one day Francis, either alone or with one other person, probably alone, just marched out from the front lines and up to the city. And he was actually well received and treated very kindly. The Sultan didn't convert, but listen to this, also from Wikipedia. Francis' visit to Egypt and attempted rapprochement with the Muslim world had far-reaching consequences long past his own death. Since after the fall of the Crusader kingdom, it would be the Franciscans of all Catholics who would be allowed to stay on in the Holy Land and be recognized as the custodians of the Holy Land on behalf of the Catholic Church. It has been argued that no one else in history was as dedicated as Francis to imitate the life and carry out the work of Christ in Christ's own way. He declared that he, quote, considered himself no friend of Christ if he did not cherish those for whom Christ died. The reason I spend so much time on one man, interestingly a Catholic, is to remind us of the influence that one poor, humble nobody can have on the entire course of history. He had no grand ambitions. He had no major goals. I say no major goals, I shouldn't say that. But he had no grandiose schemes. All he wanted to do was to love God's beautiful creation and humbly do his very best to follow in the footsteps of Jesus. And he ended up altering history, in a sense, because of that. So, okay, I'm just trying to think what I see what I can leave out here. Meanwhile, in India and Persia, the Christian communities remained small, as I said earlier, but were full of life and energy. But being in different empires, they were pretty much cut off from other Christian contact. By now, I'm thinking that was probably for their good. At this time, we see what Scott Sundquist calls the Jesuit advance into Asia. The Jesuits were also a Catholic order, also really not aligned with the Catholic political agenda, and their approach was a bit more of a military style. They took a vow that they were simply They were here and they were ready to go. And when they were told to go wherever, as if they were in an army, they would go, and they would encounter whatever danger they needed to follow their orders. They took a very radical approach for that time in being very sensitive to the culture. They had a high value of the native culture, the native language. They did translation work. One man went so far as to become an Indian holy man. He followed Christ, but to the Indians, he was an Indian holy man. And this approach was not exactly popular with the home church, but it gained influence with both upper and lower caste members of society. Remember, this is a Hindu society. Just elsewhere in the world, just some milestones to point to. Around the time St. Francis was converted was around the same time that Genghis Khan was beginning his reign of terror in Asia. Okay, so toward the end of this era, we have the Protestant Reformation. And just, there's a tremendous, once again, flourishing of the faith. And this was a time of tremendous missionary outreach. This Protestant era, there was Christian movement and missionary outreach like the world had never seen before. So we say, yay for the reformers, right? Actually very wrong. Ralph Winter says that although this was a wonderful time in the church of great revival, where scripture was taken seriously and theology and scholarship grew tremendously, once again, it was focused inward. And for the first 200 years, from 1600 to 1800, with maybe a few exceptions, Winter says the Protestants did not even speak of missionary outreach. All of the mission effort during this time was by the Catholic Church, to the point that many Catholics considered the Protestants apostate simply for their lack of missionary effort. So we're not necessarily the good guys in this picture. Taking a big jump now to much more modern history. From 1600 and on, Europe and thus Christianity had footholds in most of the non-Western world, the rest of the world. And over the centuries, Europe and nominal Christianity gained more and more power, until by 1945, Europeans had virtual control over 99.5% of the non-Western world. That surprised me greatly. That is, once again, according to Ralph Winter. 99.5% of the non-Western world. But in this time, once again, are we getting tired of hearing it yet? It was tied to empire. To become Christian in many ways meant aligning yourself with the Western Empire. World War II pretty much shook Europe loose, and in the 25 years between 1945 and 1969, Europe's control of the Eastern world dropped from 99.5% to only 5% in 25 years. As a result of that collapse of power came an explosion of Christianity, because finally, after so many centuries, people were free to embrace the gospel without also embracing Europe. And I have to ask, will we ever learn? My deep concern is that we as the Western world would actually learn from history. If we did, we may be the first generation in 2,000 years to do so. This cycle needs to end. As I reflected on this troubling history, I feel like the Lord is showing me something, and it's a bit scary to say it, but I'm just going to put it out there, is that it seems that there is a spirit of control that is dominating Western Christianity, and that has dominated it from the time of Christ on, or shortly after the time of Christ. There are so many bright spots throughout history where humble people rose up and risked their lives, and also rejection from their fellow Christians. And these communities of vibrant faith sprung up. But kind of the overarching theme that I see coming out is that Christianity always gets pulled back to a connection with empire. And it makes it turns it into something toxic that is simply repulsive to our neighbors that need it. And we see it in a compulsion to westernize the people we minister to. If we go to Asia, if we go to Africa, wherever we go, we have this innate need for them to become like us. And there are times when the culture is directly against Christianity, and that, of course, needs to be addressed. But so much of that is simply a need, I feel, to control and to be how do I say this? Well, just to be in control, for lack of a better word. I hope I'm wrong on that, but contemplate that. As I was nearing the end of this study, I felt like although so many of these travesties in history are not our fault, we did not cause them, is it right to say that maybe we should still repent for that? Are we willing to own up to our desire for control and for all other Christians to be like us? And are we willing to meet people on their own level and share the gospel with them without them without them feeling like there's a whole slew of things outside of Christianity that they need to accept as well. I'll leave you with a final warning from Ralph Winter. I apologize for going over time. He says simply, "The kingdom of God will not stop with us, but it may leave us behind. And may it not be so." Thank you for your attention. You may be dismissed for a five-minute break. Thank you.